Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and I'm so happy you are with us today. Well, it's the beginning of December, and I can say it is still 80 degrees here in the Deep South. Although there seems to be a lot of change that'll be coming across the country, a lot of icing and snow to bring us right into the holiday mood. But did you ever notice when you're not feeling well, or if you're having some issues with your health that are rather serious at the time, or if you're having a lot of life events and changes, the holidays just don't seem the same? So while it is such a happy time of year, a lot of people aren't feeling that happy. And how do they be able to go on in their lives when they know they have these challenges? How can you have a challenge and be able to say, I'm going to get up every day? How could you have a diagnosis and say, everything will be okay? So today, we are going to be talking about how to live a life after a diagnosis. And we will be speaking with an author of the book, When All That's Left of Me Is Love. Because really, bottom line, that's really all there is. And that's why you get up every single day. That's why it's important. Today, we will be speaking with Linda Campanella. She is the author of the book, When All That's Left of Me Is Love. And it's a daughter's story of letting go. She has an account of her mother's last year of life and her family's participation in it. You know, when something happens, as a death, sometimes they're sudden. There really is no preparation, and things just seem to fly by at rapid speed, and you only have things to look back on. But when you have time and you know of a diagnosis, many times clients come to me and they say, you know, I have 6 months, I have a year, what do I do? And we go around the circle and we think about it. What should we do? Get our affairs in order, you know, see what's important to us. But when it really comes down to it, you just want to sit with the people you're with and just have those moments where you can connect with them, share how you feel, and share how important they are to you in your life. So I'd like to welcome Linda to the show. Linda, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I look forward to our chat.
So can you relate where, you know, when a death is sudden, it's so different, and you don't have those opportunities, but you had a wonderful opportunity. Well, relatively speaking, you had the opportunity, and that was very important to you to share with your mother.
Absolutely. It didn't feel wonderful at the time. You're right about
right. That.
It shook the earth beneath me when my father called and asked if I was sitting down and then proceeded to tell me that my 73-year-old mother had been diagnosed that day with terminal lung cancer. So it certainly didn't feel wonderful, but as I came to learn in the course of the weeks and months that followed, we had in many ways been given a gift in the form of a terminal diagnosis, and I'm sure we'll probe that a little bit later in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, because there's so many people don't have that. You know, and it's such a blessing when you even have a day, a week, or a month, or even as you have had a year, because when you don't have it, it just seems to have taken your guts and you can't get them back. Some people do feel that, you know? So can
tell
us a little bit about what your thoughts are on that?
Well, I actually am in a position to compare and contrast the two different scenarios,
right. Believe
it or not. My mother was diagnosed in September 2008, as I said, with terminal lung cancer. And as you said, she lived a year and a day from that moment of diagnosis. And it was a wonderful year that I really would love to talk with you and your listeners about. So she died in September 2009. 5 days before she died, after her long illness, my father-in-law had a massive stroke and died on the spot. So we in my family, and my family consists of my husband and our three sons, my immediate family anyway, were in a position where within a span of 1 week we lost somebody after a year-long terminal illness and somebody whom we had expected to live for years and years. And it was very interesting how we reacted to the two deaths and how the spouses who were left behind reacted. My father's grief has been quite different than my mother-in-law's grief, for example, because she did not have a chance to say goodbye. There were many things that were left unsaid. Whereas in the case of my mother and our year-long journey through terminal illness, we left nothing unsaid, and by the time she died, we were feeling very much at peace and very grateful for the gifts that we had received, many unexpected gifts. So it is really very different, and I can't say that either one of those scenarios is good or better because they're both brutal to lose anybody, whether expected or after a long goodbye. You know, it's not a happy occasion. But in my mother's case, I feel personally very grateful for the chance to have said goodbye, even though it was a long, excruciating one.
You know, you had written in the beginning of your book that it goes without saying, but it should not go unsaid. But I think that should be maybe our mantra for our daily life instead of waiting till an event is potentially on the horizon, you know?
Well,
and how many people can do that?
Well, that is one of the lessons that I've taken from the experience that I've had with terminal illness and death, and it's in part one reason I chose to write the book, because I think many of us need a reminder that no one is promised tomorrow. There's no guarantee that the people we love are going to be around next week to find out and hear from us how much we love them. So, yeah, it goes without saying, but I love you should not go unsaid. And, you know, thinking about death makes us think about life. And that is certainly something that I have taken from my experience and try to carry with me every day. You know, facing death, we really finally learn how we should live, as odd as that sounds.
Well, no, it absolutely is the truth. And because, you know, I can remember just recently, my mother lives in California, and a man who was battling cancer for over 5 years lives across the street. And he was on his last few days, and his family was all around. And she said that the dogs in the neighborhood were howling for days on end. And then the cats started to howl too. The entire neighborhood knew this man's time was passing. And it brought everybody in the neighborhood to their knees. My mother hadn't spoken to anyone for months since that. And because it was just, it was like almost like the sky was opening up and all these people were experiencing and feeling this man's pain. And my parents are in their 80s, and I guess that just shook them too, to be able to realize their own, you know, imminent time could be at any time also, you know. And that is not the easiest thing to be able to sense. You know, people come to me and they say, my doctor says, you know, I have no time left. Go home and make my affairs. I'm coming to you to save me. You know, and my first instinct and response is, I can't save you. I can help you, but I can't save you.
Mm-hmm.
And how hard that is. I have to, you know, help them maybe with their choices for hospice or help them in feeling and saying what you do in your book is, you know, say those words that they need to be saying and be there for that with them. But, you know, when your time is your time, there isn't just that miracle all the time.
No, there isn't. And, you know, I think in our society, well, there are a couple of things that I could observe. One is we don't talk about death enough. And the other is when one is given a terminal diagnosis, you know, cancer, for example, even a late-stage cancer, there is still this kind of warrior mentality where you can't accept the reality of what's inevitable. Rather, you have to fight it. And I'm of the view that to accept the reality of what's inevitable doesn't make us weak and doesn't make us a quitter. You know, somebody said to my mother that she was a warrior for love and hope. She wasn't a warrior against her cancer. She was a warrior for love and for living affirmatively and gracefully until the very end. So I think we need to talk more about death in our society so that it's not such a scary thing when we finally confront it. It's not easy to talk about dying, but I think we really need to talk about death, because if we're not talking about it, we're also not preparing for it, which is another problem, I believe. in our society. We put it off. We were in denial about it. And then suddenly we're confronted with it. None of us is going to escape it. So we should prepare for it and talk about it and make sure that our wishes are known to those whom we love and who want to give us a good death. And at some point stop fighting and just accept the reality and kind of change one's notion of what hope is, from a hope to survive to a hope to live out with grace and peace and no pain.
I do that right now with a lot of clients, and we always talk about it, and we say, we're going to talk about it. And they're like, well, no, we're not. That's dark. And I said, No, we're going to say, hey, I'm going to die. It's going to be there. It's going to happen. Okay. So we go through 2 or 3 days of, you know, what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, how it's going to be, and we say, okay, the end of the week, let's close that book. Now, what are you going to do today from here on out? And that's the difference. You know, go through all the feelings
right.
and go through all the conversations and have all of those, I'm angry, I'm mad, I feel cheated, it's not right. And once all of those are passed, then you can get to the core of what the reason for living is in the first place, is just loving each other, and there is no difference, you know. So no matter how we put it, loving, you know, a living life is not about I have to worry about who's going to get what in my money and, you know, all that other stuff. It doesn't matter. So having those conversations prior and having everybody up in arms and then saying, done, you know, move to the next page is the most important
right.
thing. And I think that's what you've done in your book.
Well, I am trying to encourage that. And I've tried to do that even after publishing the book by being very active as an advocate for hospice care and palliative care and for conversations about death so that we're ready for it and not afraid of it. I think hospice care needs to be demystified in our society, and death itself needs to be demystified by talking about it. You know, there's a very cool, well, cool is probably not the best word for it, but to me it's a very interesting initiative started by the prize-winning author Ellen Goodman. She started something called the Conversation Project. I don't know if you've heard about it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It was on ABC News not too long ago, and she's trying to encourage mm-hmm. families to talk about end-of-life care options at the kitchen table instead of in the ambulance or in the ER when it's probably too late to let people know what we want. And
right.
I think it's a great initiative. Some of your listeners might want to Google that and find out more. It's really encouraging people to talk about their wishes for end-of-life care while there's still time to talk about it.
So can you start to tell us a little bit about how you started with your book? I know it was a reflective writing, but you were keeper of the records, as you had said. You kept all the information, and then you looked back?
Well, I did. As I said, my mom was diagnosed at age 73 in 2008, and after getting that diagnosis, I went right to anticipatory grief, which was really overwhelming and paralyzing, at least for 48 hours. But after that 48-hour period of initial shock, I had, I suppose, what one could call an epiphany, and that was that although she had been given a terminal diagnosis, her life wasn't over, and there was still a lot of living to do, and in fact, waiting to die was no way to live. And so at that point, 24 hours or 48 hours after she was diagnosed, I really committed myself to making sure that we injected as much living into her dying as possible. And we didn't know how much time there was going to be, but I resolved that however much time there was left was going to be really good time. And so my siblings, there are three others besides myself in the family, all bought into that, and we decided that we were going to really focus on living, not dying. And that's what we did for 12 months, and I wrote about a number of the ways in which we did that in the book. But the idea for a book, to get back to your question now, was really suggested to me indirectly by my brother, who, 6 or 8 months into our journey, said to me, you know, Linda, you should really write a book and call it Living While Dying. And I'm sure that he shared that idea with me because he thought we were doing some really special things, but I think he also believed that our approach to terminal illness might, in fact, be helpful to other people. So at the time, I just kind of suppressed the idea, thinking, oh, that's such a lovely thing for him to say, but I'm not going to write a book. However, As soon as she died, I found myself lying awake at night or driving around town, and ideas for chapter headings would pop into my head, and suddenly paragraphs would begin to form. And it became obvious to me that there was actually some writing in my head that needed to come out. And so I just started writing. I started writing 2 months after she died, and I was done within 2.5 months. It just poured right out of me. Clearly, it was a cathartic expression of my grief, but that's how it flowed. And it really does focus on how we had such a joyful and purposeful last year with my mother that was filled with love and laughter and, above all, life. So that's how it started and how it kind of popped out of me.
Well, you know what I also find, too, is that when people say, well, we have this potentially little bit of time, what are we going to do? They always think of a bucket list and, well, she wants to jump out of a plane, or she needs to go down the Ganges River, or all of these things, and we have to rush and find money and do this and do that. And it's like that really is so far from what people are really about and what they're really looking for in life. I mean, that may be the outside expression of them, but that certainly is not their inner core. Have you found that at all in this experience, some different insight into
that?
Yeah,
from other people. Yeah, other people who've shared their own stories. I know that in my mother's case, her bucket list consisted of one thing, family. She just wanted to spend as much time as she had with the people who meant the most to her in this world and whom she didn't want to leave behind. And, you know, some of us looking in might have said, oh, maybe we want to try to do this. We could have easily have come up with a bucket list for her, but it wasn't what she wanted. So I think it's really important for people who are dealing with loved ones facing terminal illness to take their cues from that loved one and not assume that they or we know what's best, and rather just listen and watch and try to be responsive and respectful when it comes to what's most important to that individual. And it's different for everybody.
And it is. And also not to get caught up in your own fears or your own expectations of what it should look like, and listen to the person themselves. I know I've had some relatives in the past when someone had died and they said, well, her wishes were to be cremated, and the other people would be like, no, I have to go visit her at the grave every single day, and that's what she wanted. Mm-hmm. I know what she told me. And the constant going back and forth tends to tear apart families even further, which was not even the intention at all in the beginning when it was really about bringing them together.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate development, and in many families, thankfully not mine, this kind of situation can bring out tension. It can bring out the worst in people, not only the best. And I suppose that's probably one reason why hospice teams include a social worker, you know, people who are trained in dealing with family dynamics in very stressful periods. But you're right, I believe, that in the final analysis, the only one whose opinion should matter is the person who is ill and facing death and should be in control of his or her own end-of-life decisions. That's my belief anyway.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's easier said than done.
That's exactly, yeah. And it is easier said than done, especially when you have people who haven't dealt with the situation at all in their own mind, and it just doesn't work for them. So they extend their fear upon everybody. You know, it's like the spewing of the dragon, you know? They're just so much anger, and it's everywhere, and anyone and anything that gets in their way is going to get it. But also, too, I think when people do have time, like your mother had time, it also can affect there, because you can have siblings who would be arguing or fighting or, you know, my time is more important or your time, or someone can go around with a little post-its and putting little notes on the bottom of everything, this is mine and that's mine. And, you know, the way the logistics play out is sometimes so, it is so strapping. I even had heard from one person one time, and this was like, I say probably in the last year or so, someone had said to me, oh, I'm going to go visit her. And it was a relative. And she says, oh, I wonder where all her dresses are going, because, you know, I really want them. I've always wanted them. I've thought about it my whole life. You know, and this person is in her late 60s. And I'm like, really? Are you kidding me? You know? But her major goal was she wanted those, and she was going to go while the person was still, quote, here, to be able to put her foot down that she was going to get those. And it's like so far off the mark, you know?
Well, I find it off the mark, and I also find it actually offensive. I think that's terrible.
Right.
It's certainly not the approach that my family took. You know, the only sense of envy that siblings might have felt was toward me because I lived the closest. My parents were only a half hour away from me, and so I became, together with my father, my mother's primary caregiver. So I had a lot of time with my parents. My brother lives in New Hampshire. One sister was living in Washington State at the time, and another in New Jersey. And although they came as often as they could, and they came often, I was with my parents, you know, all the time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And because we knew time was limited, they were envious of me that I was having a little bit more. But it was a beautiful envy. It wasn't an ugly envy. And, you know, at the same time, they were also grateful to me for the amount of time I was spending, you know, injecting living into my mom's dying. So it was all very positive in our family, and I'm grateful for that. That's one of many things that I'm grateful. We didn't have any breakdowns in relationships. In fact, we all got much closer. It was really beautiful. But I want to come back to something you said, because we didn't know we had time with my mother. As it turned out, we had a year and a day. But when she was diagnosed, she had advanced lung cancer with metastases to the brain. There were 4 brain tumors, and my dad is a radiologist. And so he knew how dire this was. My mother had grown up in a medical family. We all knew that this was really bad. And frankly, my parents thought it would be lucky if she had a couple of months. So we were planning for a short period of time and praying for a longer period of time. You know, and one of the things with terminal illness is it's impossible to know definitively how much time is left. And we never asked that question. And, you know, I think in the end we don't really want to know the answer to the question, how long.
Right.
So we kind of assumed it could be a year, it could be 2 years. And we just kept trying to live with a sense of no boundaries, hoping that it would be longer than we imagined. And as it turned out, it was. So we didn't know it was going to be 2 months.
Yeah, and I think when you wake up in the morning and you say, wow, yahoo, it's another day.
That's the
right
way to do it, exactly.
Is the gift right there.
The trick is to be in the moment. Every day is a gift, and you wake up. I remember looking into my mother's eyes. I would go to her house early in the morning because my dad was still working, and she'd still be sleeping, and my father would have peeled a clementine for my mother and put it on his pillow next to her so that when she woke up, she had a clementine. And if you imagine that I can eat a clementine today without thinking of my mother, you're wrong. But anyway, I would be there when she woke up, and I can still see the look in her eyes when she opened them and saw me there. And she was just so happy that it was another day and that we were going to have another mother-daughter day. So, yeah, every day is a gift. And frankly, I think going back to something we were talking about earlier, that's how we should all live our lives. Whether we've been given a terminal diagnosis or not, we should wake up and thank the good heavens that we have another day to enjoy. It's a gift.
And I think while there is contrast with what I said and what you said and experienced, it is important for the listeners to know that all of these ranges of things do happen. So if you are a listener and you're listening and you're saying, my family's not happy. My family's not going through it the good way, you know, and I can hear you. I know what you're saying, Dr. Jeanette, and I get it. That's how mine is. Or if it's the opposite, our family is doing really great and we're happy we don't have that other stuff. But there's a full range. But what you and I, Linda, are both saying is that all of that stuff is out there, and it's really up to you to be able to decide for yourself what works. Because some families have never been happy or good, you know,
that's
and
right.
To expect them to change something at the end is almost asking, like, you know, for the parting of the Red Seas. You know, it just isn't going to happen, and they're today for them.
Right.
But they still need to go on. So really what we're what Linda and I are both saying is take little bits and pieces from what we're saying and say, hey, I got it. I'm just like that. So I'm not crazy. I'm not abnormal. Our family isn't totally over the boundaries. That's not what she and I are both saying. What we're both saying is just take a little sense. Hey, if you get up in the morning and, you know, if you may have an extended period of time with your parents or whatever and your parents are sick as anything or maybe can't even remember who you are, you can't sometimes get up and say, Yahoo, it's another day. I get that, and Linda gets that too. But what we're saying is just say, get up. And when you get up, just open your eyes and say, okay, next. And you have to think, okay, next. What do you do next? What should I do next? You know, and how can we keep moving forward? Because absolutely no one's, you could not take out of this whole entire world and sit down two people and say they had the exact same experience. Not going to happen. They're similar. They're not the same. So to try to find and say, you know, oh, well, I'm going to do it this way because so-and-so said to do it that way, we really can't always say that because that really is not a true factor. So don't feel bad if you haven't had this experience with your family. But do know that you have an option to try. And the option to try is to say, what's available to me? What can I do? And how can that come about? And that's what Linda and I are saying.
Oh, that's put very, very, very nicely. I do think that we have a lot to learn from each other by sharing our stories. And you're right. Everybody is different. Every circumstance is different. And not every mother-daughter relationship is as strong as mine was. I'm reminded of that daily, and it makes me so grateful for what I have, and I realize that not everybody does. But there are some lessons perhaps to be learned. You know, one thing to keep in mind is how good it feels not to have any regrets. And sometimes the terminal illness is an opportunity for healing within families that are not as close as mine was. You know, death or a terminal illness can be a gift in that respect as well, a time for people to realize how wonderful it would be to finally forgive somebody. So,
and people can carry anger, illness, pain, death for their entire life. I know of some other acquaintances where they had a death of a newborn. And I'll tell you, it shaped their life for the rest of their lives. They could not do anything without anger in their voice, and it just was the way it was. And you couldn't say, I'm going to change it or I wish it was better, because it just was what they chose. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes, you know, I had another friend who also had taken care of his mother with Alzheimer's after taking care of his father with Alzheimer's. You know, and that's not easy either, because you really are just sitting there watching a person not being able to be themselves. So
yeah, that's a terrible disease.
Yeah, and it really is. And this person watched that happen for 5 years, and it was just like, how can you keep going? But they do, and they do. So can you tell us a little bit about your book now? We got a little bit of background, but you wrote a lot of emails. Why did you find emails were important?
Oh, yeah. So when I set about writing the book in those first months after my mother died, I was trying to remember and reconstruct things, and it occurred to me that I had actually kept kind of a running record that I could revisit in the form of all the emails that I had sent to siblings whom I was trying to keep updated, and to my mom's friends and to my children, and even to my parents, back and forth to my parents. So I, as I was starting to write, went back into my emails, and it occurred to me as I was doing that that rather than use them as source material, I could actually use them verbatim in my book as a way of allowing readers to really experience what we were experiencing and to feel our emotions firsthand by letting them come right into them, by reading our words that were written as things were happening. So I decided to include many, many emails in my book, and it, I think, adds authenticity and really draws the reader in as though he or she was experiencing it with us.
And I
did
think
you,
when
did
you
find
write,
it...
Yes,
was helpful
I did.
In that regard.
And what I found also is what I find for myself too, and maybe others will experience this also, is that sometimes when you have to pick up the phone and you need to say something and it just can't come out the right way, or it just can't come out the way you want it to, or the words aren't there, when you sit down and you write it out and just say, I'm just going to close my eyes and I'm going to write this out and I'm going to just say it from my heart, and don't judge and don't revisit or review or anything. Just write it from your heart, push send. You know, close your eyes, push send. And what that is that's so much closer to your inner being, who you are, of your spirit, versus being able to shelter or protect with, you know, your choice or selections of words.
Right. A lot of people, and I'm certainly one of them, process their thoughts by writing. So for me, it was a way of finding that quiet space and place where I could be alone with my thoughts and let them come out. And it's important, I think, to let many thoughts come out rather than allow them to fester inside. So I wrote a lot, and when I was doing those emails, I had no clue I would ever use them as a book. I wasn't writing in order to generate source material. I was writing, as you said, to sort of process my thoughts and to share my authentic emotions with people. And then I've heard from bereavement counselors, just while we're on the topic of writing, how important it is for people who are dealing with grief and loss to write, even if it's just a journal. It doesn't have to be an email to anybody, and it doesn't have to be a book. It's just, you know, put your thoughts on paper. Let them come out. They need to come out. Mine came out in the form of a book, but others just journal. And it's really, really helpful in healing, from what I understand.
And even when sometimes people start to journal, they may say, I don't like to write. So write down, I don't like to write. The next day, pick it up again.
Right.
Write something out.
Mm-hmm.
But the key part is that you turn the page. In other words, you don't write a continuous page, dates on one page. I hate to write with today's date, turn the page. When tomorrow comes, you have a blank page. And on that blank page, you could say, I'm really angry. Next day, turn the page. I'm really angry. Next day, turn the page. I'm really so angry. Next day, turn the page. Next day, next day. And eventually, it will start to change the words. Because you can only keep saying those so many times, and your body says, okay, we got you angry. What next? And your body will start to say, I got it. I got it. I got it. And then eventually you'll say, okay, I got it too. Next. But it does take a long time. And for people who really want to write things down, you're going to write about your anger, because I'm sure you must have had some anger at this time. And did your mother have any anger, your family? Many people do, and that is acceptable, because it is a process.
It's certainly a natural emotion. I can't say that anger was the one that we felt most intensely. Neither my mother nor those that she was going to be leaving behind, we felt sad. I mean, the overwhelming feeling was sadness and grief, actually. We began to grieve prematurely, and that's, I think, something that happens with a terminal diagnosis. We are catapulted straight to grief and then need to reel ourselves back in and realize that nobody has died yet. We're still living, and there's plenty of living to do. But we had anxiety. We had fear. We had, you know, plenty of fear, I'll say that, not anger, but anxiety, fear, and a lot of sadness. And I know that in my mom's case, she asked us not to be glum. That was her word, don't be glum. She didn't want it to be, as she called it, a pity party. She wanted us to you know, be happy and to keep living fully and joyfully. And while we certainly tried to do that when we were with her, every time I left her house, I had this wave of sadness just explode out of me, and I would sob oftentimes driving home. And so while I didn't want to show that to her necessarily, these were emotions that needed to come out, and that's another reason why I would write. And I know that in my mom's case, she felt she needed to be strong for my father. And so she had this outward appearance of strength, and I know on the inside she had a lot of fears of her own, which is another reason why hospice is such a gift, because there was a spiritual counselor who was part of her hospice team. And my mother was able to talk with the spiritual counselor about some of her angst and her fears and her sadness, and she could do it in a safe place without my father necessarily observing. I don't know if that made sense, but you know, it's important for us to have an outlet for our emotions, whether it's through a hospice spiritual counselor or on paper. There are some things that we just have to let out.
Can you tell us a little bit about her experience with that, how that worked?
With hospice?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. She was doing very, very well for about 6 or 7 months, and in July of 2009, she had a massive seizure that signaled that her disease had progressed to a new stage and a new level. And at that point, her doctor suggested that it was time for us to transition to hospice care. And I'd love to talk about hospice quite a bit, but I'll take my cues from you. First, I'll talk, though, about how the hospice team included a spiritual counselor whose name, as it turns out, was Faith. And I thought that was wonderful for her to be named Faith as a spiritual counselor. And in the last 3 months of my mother's life, when we were paired up with hospice, Faith would visit fairly frequently and have conversations with my mother, and I was often part of those, where my mom felt it was a wonderful way to talk about subjects that she wasn't necessarily inclined to talk with her family about, namely her fears about death and what life after death might look like. And the spiritual counselor was wonderful in sharing experiences and stories that she had heard from others, and it made my mother so calm and so open to possibilities that death would not be the end of relationships that she had cherished so much during her lifetime. My mother was really worried about being a burden to her family members, and the hospice spiritual counselor was absolutely brilliant and so loving in helping my mother understand that she was not a burden to us, that in fact she was giving us the gift of giving. So my mother had wonderful experiences with the hospice spiritual counselor in particular, but with the whole team. The hospice is a team. It's a nurse, a spiritual counselor, a social worker, a bereavement counselor for the family after somebody has died. And they really take a holistic approach to the patient, not only taking care of the body, but also the mind, the emotions, the spirit. And hospice takes care of the whole family, too. It's a tremendous, tremendous gift to people confronting end of life.
And I think also to know that there are support systems out there, because it is not easy to go through it by yourself and to be able to have the courage to ask for help. Even
Absolutely.
Though you are, you know, doing it on your own, you were there for her all the time, but you still needed someone else.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think too few people know what hospice is, and too many believe that it's something it isn't. And so people are afraid of it. And when it's offered, they don't want it because they think it means giving up hope or that the end of life is imminent. And it's not true. None of those things is true. Hospice can be with you for 6 months, and what a wonderful resource and support system it represents. And it's really all about quality of living as much as it is about peaceful dying. Hospice is fantastic, and it saddens me that so few people know what it is, and that the majority of people only have hospice in the last couple of days or weeks of their lives rather than for as many months as they are entitled to enjoy hospice care.
Yes, I think
I'm really working hard.
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You get the 6 months that you're entitled to for hospice care that a lot of people don't really know, you know, if my clock ticked up to that 6 months and now I can get it, you know. So everybody mm-hmm. tries to put it off as long as they possibly can because they really aren't sure what that end of time might be. And I guess maybe that's where it leaves a lot of doubt in people's minds about how can they get help or how can they not get help too.
Right. And a lot of people think it's just for cancer patients, or they think that it's just for pain management at the end, and some people think it hastens death. There's many, many misconceptions about hospice, and I think that as soon as somebody is diagnosed with a terminal disease, there should be a hospice care consultation or a palliative care consult that very first day so that families and patients know what is available. because you're right, at some point people are going to be sort of disinclined to ask the question because they don't want to know the answer. But if it's out of the way at the beginning, and you were sort of hinting that at that earlier, Jeanette, that to cover these topics at the beginning makes a lot of sense. And then people are armed with information and able to make much better decisions, I think.
And once you take the anger, the fear, and the grief out of it, I mean, if you can say, you know, I'm really mad, like we just got done saying with the journaling and stuff, I'm angry. Mm-hmm. If you do that, I'm angry for, you know, 5 to 10 days if you have to. By the time it's over with, you really don't have anything left in you of that anger. So expend all of that, like you did with the first 48 hours. Expend all of that grief. Expend all of that extra stuff that really isn't part of the process anyway at that time.
Yeah, I think that's good advice.
So can you tell us a little bit more? We have about, we're rolling for the hour. We have about 15 more minutes left. Share some of the highlights, because there are many highlights that you do talk about in the book. And the highlights are, as we said before, getting up and being there, you know, and seeing the smile on your mother's face. I mean, you even found, you know, that at the end of the book, you have the little card about, you know, getting up and the saint card.
Right,
you know,
right.
And, you know, you find those things or know those things about your family member afterwards, but you know that you can see that, reflect back that that's how they live their life. And you could say, yeah, you know, I did see that every day. She got up and, like you said, she had a smile on her face. She was there, you know. So that is a highlight.
Well, boy, there were so many highlights. I think one that comes to my mind immediately is the happy hour tradition that we started during this journey through terminal illness. And it started one evening when I decided that when my father came back from work, and it was a day when I was with my mother in her home while my dad worked, that we would have a happy hour to greet him when he came home. And it wasn't a happy hour for the alcohol necessarily, although we did, I confess, pop a bottle of wine each time, but it was really about setting aside a time of day when we could be very intentional about being together and being happy in our togetherness. And because it was such a great time the first couple of times we did it, we started doing it all the time, as often as we could. Whenever I was there, certainly whenever any of my siblings visited, sometimes we would invite my parents' friends to come for a happy hour. And even as her disease progressed and she was first in a wheelchair and then in a hospital bed, we were still having happy hours. And these were incredibly happy moments where we laughed and we told stories and we were together. And even after she died, the tradition of happy hour has continued in our family, and it's a great way of actually keeping her with us, because it's hard to do that without remembering her and keeping her with us. So happy hour was certainly a highlight, and people who've read the book have written to me and said that it's something they've tried. Or even if they haven't tried, it was something that really moved them. So happy hour was great. And it was really another example of our being in the moment and really committing ourselves to having fun, making fun, and being happy, even in the face of something that was going to end in a way we didn't want it to end. So that was certainly a highlight. Another highlight I think I might share has to do with how we used a calendar. Oftentimes people think of terminally ill patients looking at their calendar and crossing off a day, thinking, phew, I survived another day, cross one more off. We use the calendar to actually look ahead to tomorrow, to next week, to next month, and to make plans. So we never stopped making plans. We didn't know how long she was going to live, but that didn't stop us from planning what we were going to do next spring. And so we put trips on the calendar. We went to shows. We scheduled things, and even if on a particular day she wasn't up to going, we didn't stop making plans. So that was a real highlight. We didn't succumb to the terminal diagnosis. We sort of ignored it and went on with living. It did not terminate living for us. So using the calendar to plan ahead, using happy hour to celebrate our family, our good day, good times was certainly a highlight. Those are two examples that come to mind quickly. Maybe you can think of others, having read the book. But
well,
another one.
So they're important because, you know, when you have a calendar and you're planning ahead, a lot of people just tend to say, you know, when you're not doing well, you're just sitting there and we're just going to while away the time with you. You know, mm-hmm. and that's not really at all what we are saying. What Linda and I are saying is you still have that moment of life and to still be, you know, in that moment and have that precious gift of that minute is the most important thing, you know. And what you did about still planning is what not many people can do, but it is an option that's out there.
Yeah, for me, it was sort of a survival strategy. It gave mm-hmm. us hope. It gave us purpose. It made us happy. We weren't thinking about things that had been done for the last time. We were thinking about things that we might do for the first time. My mother and I had our first side-by-side mani-pedi. It was fabulous. You know, and you know, I still see her to this day. You know, the people doing our toes were admiring how great her hair looked, and it was her wig. And the person said, "I can't believe that's your wig." And my mother was just so filled with joy. She said, "Well, it is." And she whipped her wig off. You know, we laughed. We had such a great time. And people will probably find that hard to believe. And I think as I was at the beginning of this process, I found it hard to believe that there was going to be any joy left. But it's possible. It's possible to laugh and to live fully, even in the face of terminal diagnosis. And I'm so thankful that we figured out ways to do it.
And I always say to people, it's going to be okay. And they look at me and they're like, no, it's not. It's not going to be okay. I'm going to have surgery. I'm going to have therapy. I'm going to have treatment. Or I may just die tomorrow. And I'm, I still say it's still okay. Because the answer mm-hmm. is that it can be nothing else but okay. There isn't any way to change that. It is going to be what it is. So it will be okay.
It's That's true.
How you present yourself. So it still is always okay.
Yeah, it makes me think of something that the famous movie critic Roger Ebert, who had cancer for many years, wrote in an essay, I think he wrote it in 2011, and the title of it was I Do Not Fear Death. And in that essay, he wrote something like, I will die sooner than most people who read this, but that doesn't shake my sense of wonder and joy. And I thought that was so wonderful. That's sort of how we try to live with my mother. Her sense of wonder and joy was not shaken. And she approached each day with that sense of wonder and joy. I think it's great if you can do it, and it's hard. And as you've said before, not everybody can do it, but it's a good thing to try anyway. And as you said, reach out and accept whatever help is offered too, because it's really tough to navigate this journey alone.
You know, and death can come at any time or any age. This is not just about cancer, or this is not just about a diagnosis that. You know, we're saying this because death can happen at any time. Mm-hmm. My daughter works in an ER, and yesterday she had just posted in the morning a picture of her leg socks that we send to her every Christmas. She's in another state. We sent her socks, and they were red and green. And so she took a picture of her socks in her hospital shoes because she works in the ER. And she says, isn't it nice that family members far away that they still think of you and, you know, you're still thought of. She thought it was touching that she got the socks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the evening, a 20-year-old woman had come in that was 38 weeks pregnant, and she had coded, which means she was not satisfied, and they tried to bring her back, and the woman didn't make it, and she had a hemorrhage in her brain, and they just, you know, took the baby out quickly, and the baby probably won't make it either. And my daughter said, How quick. I was mm-hmm. just writing about my Christmas socks, and that happened.
Right.
And my daughter's yep. only in her early 20s. And it's like how we tend to look at every second like there's always going to be, years and years, oh, leave me alone. And, you know, here she is, early 20s, saying, you know, that woman is younger than me, and she's done, and I don't know. And they all had counseling. Everybody in the ER had to go through counseling to be able to go back to work because this was shaking them to their core, too. We always think that, you know, healthcare workers or family caregivers or spouses or siblings or daughters or whatever it might be can handle it, when really it's not all about handling it either. I mean, I'm sure you had a lot of thoughts going through you and a lot of things that you had to go through. You can't deny the grief, the pain, or the sorrow, or, you know, what if that's me? You have to go through it. You cannot go around it.
No, that's very true. You don't get over it. You have to go through it. And what you've said reminds me of another great organization that I've become familiar with. It's called the Schwartz Center for Compassionate Healthcare. And among its commitments is taking care of healthcare providers who experience some very, very awful things, including those difficult emotions, such as what your daughter experienced just the other day. It's hard to confront death. It's hard to tell somebody that she has a terminal diagnosis. It's hard to sit across from a daughter who's crying because her father is going to die. Or it's hard, you know, how many scenarios can we imagine that are going to take a toll on healthcare providers? And so the Schwartz Center for Compassionate Healthcare is very tuned into helping healthcare providers help each other through these difficult times and emotions. So it's a great organization. You might even want to check it out yourself. It's tough. It's tough on both ends of the diagnosis, the one who's rendering it and the one who's receiving it. You know, it's not easy to be mortal.
And people they don't become hardened to it either. You know, people say, well, that's your job. You have to do it. No. Mm-hmm. If that's not what makes a human being, I mean, that's means that you have to have a heart and a spirit, and everybody will feel everything around them.
Well, this is going to sound maybe kind of hokey, but another one of the wonderful gifts that I experienced in connection with my mother's illness and death is a reminder of how innately good people are. You know, there were so many expressions of love and connectedness and unexpected gifts. People were just so good, caregivers, friends, even strangers who all embraced us on this journey. And so to see and experience so much goodness in people was a very affirming, beautiful part of this journey. It's nice to be reminded of that.
And it is important because, you know, you have to know that others have felt the same way you did. You can't all feel like we're just alone in this because you're not alone in it. And, you know, the more reaching out you do, the more comforting and compassion you will feel.
Right. I think it's so important to share our stories. Again, I didn't realize it when I was writing it, but from how people have reacted to my book, I have found that we all need to share our stories, and we connect with each other when we're telling our individual stories. And there's always something that we have in common in some deep place inside our hearts. And it's good to feel those connections with other people and to learn from each other. It really is.
Well, we have come right up on the end of the hour. Linda, can you give us some information about your website and how the listeners might purchase your book?
Oh, thank you. I would love to do that. The name of the book, again, is When All That's Left of Me is Love. It is available on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, and I think other places as well. And you can find out more about me and about my wonderful mother and the book on a website that is Linda Campanella. That's all one word, Linda Campanella, C-A-M-P-A-N-E-L-L-A, dot Tate Author, one word, Tate, TateAuthor.com, LindaCampanella.TateAuthor.com. And I would love to hear from anybody who has had similar experiences or who has read the book, and I'd like to strike up dialogue with anybody who wants to contact me.
So you do have a page there with Contact Us where they can send an email to you directly, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I've had some wonderful conversations. I've met some great people. And as I said earlier, those human connections are really, really affirming and helpful. Even though it's been 4 years since my mother passed away, it's nice to keep talking about her and to see how my experience compares with others. And so, yes, I would love to hear from anybody.
Well, it was great having you with us today. It's been Yeah, I'm sure for a lot of people hearing both sides and hearing many different sides, but also hearing a lot of tips that they'd be able to say, you know, I'm not alone, I do understand it, and that's how I'm feeling too. So those things you and I may both be saying, maybe touching them where they would say, oh, okay, I can let that one go. That's normal, or that's what the process is, and I will be okay. And that's to remember, as we've always said, is that it will always be okay. So that's always important to remember. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Dr. Jeanette. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And if anyone would like more information about Linda, there is all of her links directly posted on today's show page, where her website is. If you didn't get all that spelling, no worries. Just go to today's description of the show. Click directly on there, and it will go directly to that page. Also, there is a link there to purchase her book, where it goes directly to Amazon. So I'd like to thank everyone for being with us today. I know this is not an easy topic, by no means. Linda and I can both tell you this is not easy, but it is something that everyone will have to experience eventually. And if you'd like to get directly in contact with Linda, please do on her Contact Us page, because she will be more than happy to listen to your stories, and if she needs to get back to you, I'm sure she will be able to do that. So thank you so much for being with us today, and until tomorrow, have a great day, and be blessed.